computer and click on that. You should be able to watch this thing take off. It's different watch sight than what you're normally used to seeing down in Florida. So I think it's just chilling pretty cool. It's by the water, but it should be a little different. Let me drive it. And by the way, brought up the telescope that's on the space station. There's going to be another one put up in maybe 4 or 5 years. It's not going to be doing the same thing. It'll be looking for exotic particles coming out of neutron stars. So called NICER, NICER. I forgot what it stands for. Something to do with exotic matter. But they're going to bring that up, launch that as, an unmanned craft, have the astronauts attached to the space station. But there's another good telescope that's going to be launched. You'll like this, Dick. It's another Kepler. They're not going to call it Kepler. They're going to call it TESS. TESS, Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Very similar, but the big difference is Kepler looks at like one part of the sky, like 0.25% of the whole sky. This thing is going to look at the whole sky. Primarily going to look at closer in stars, and it's going to do the same thing as Kepler. It's going to look for the transits. It's going to look for the dimming of the stars and photo sensors all over it. Drop it. WS2N. The difference is they have a lot of telescopes all on the same spacecraft. And that's how they're going to do it. And the good news for Kepler, even though it was launched in 2009, I thought the mission was coming to an end, that got an extension up until 2016, which is nice. I mean, there's not going to even be a gap, because this test telescope is going to be launched the next year in 2017. So I thought that was pretty good. One other thing I want to quickly cover is the SLS, the Space Launch System that NASA's contracted to build. It's actually ahead of schedule, about 5 to 6 months ahead of schedule. First planned launch of this thing is actually next year. Drop it. Not the launch vehicle itself, but they plan on launching the Orion spacecraft on. They're not going to put it on this rocket, but this rocket will be test-fired in 2017. And what they'll do then is they'll put a Orion spacecraft on top of it, and they're going to launch that actually to the moon. So that's going to be their test. That'll be an unmanned flight, but this thing's going to be launched. Orion spacecraft next year, and they're going to launch that about 3,000 miles out and bring it back, and they want to test their heat shield. So it'll be the first designed manned spacecraft that will be going further than low Earth orbit. First time the moon flight, they're going to have a spacecraft capable of doing that. They'll do that next year. And that's pretty much it for the space portion of the net. I'm looking for the future of the SLS, the Space Launch System, with the amount of thrust. It's going to have more power than Saturn V. Saturn V is what the rocket that took us to the moon. So it's going to be a big rocket that will eventually launch from Florida. Back to you, Dick. WX2N for any questions.
That's your football.
Go right ahead, John.
Paul, it's my understanding that Obama did not cut the budget this year for NASA, but he added $200 million, evidently for new research, I believe, for spacecraft. Do you know if that's for new manned spacecraft? Do you know anything about it?
I read the budget thing, and it kind of glazed over after a while. I'm always looking for the technical things that are going on, but I know they're limited. All these projects are limited now. Like the test telescope had to be under a certain $1 million. The one going to the space station, the nice telescope attached to the space station, had to be under around $55 million or something. So I guess there's going to be a limit on a lot of the things that come up. But I haven't read the overall budget. It's usually generally around $3 billion, I think, for NASA, or something like that. Any kind of a cut is a problem. But I haven't heard any programs being cut yet. I mean, they're doing weird things like, hold on, you gotta drop it. Maybe some big science meeting out west somewhere. All the different organizations, like SpaceX and Sierra Nevada and orbital science, like the ones that are going to be launching the Antares. They're all going to be going to this big space symposium, and you know, thousands of people show up and make a big deal out of it. They talk to one another and see what they're going to do in the future. They have guest speakers and all. Well, none of NASA people are going to go. Funding is tight, so they're not going to send them. It's kind of weird, but I mean, they had certain people are going to talk. Bolden, the administrator, he was going to go. Nobody's going, so I guess we're going to try to keep things within budget, John. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that Kepler telescope is the one that's looking at a very small patch of sky and is very carefully looking at the light output of each one of those stars. And the philosophy on this one was that on the assumption that the orbital plane of the planets going around those stars just happens to be parallel to our point of view, that means that these planets, or at least some of them, will pass in front of that star. And when they do, they create a small amount of shadow. And so what Kepler is capable of doing is seeing an extremely small change in apparent light output from the star because of the shadowing of the planet. And as the planet crosses in front of the star, there's a very characteristic curve of the planet slowly coming across the surface of the star. And therefore you get the light dipping down with sort of a trapezoidal pattern. It stays dipped down during the time that the planet is in front of the star. And then as the planet exits the apparent view of the star surface is where the light comes back up again. By looking at the amount of depth and the timing, you eventually figure out how big is the orbit, how fast is the planet moving, how big is the planet, does the planet have atmosphere. You get a lot of atmosphere, you get a lot of information out of that seemingly simple measurement. And yes, it's only a couple percent of the planets going around a star are properly aligned. Their ecliptic, their orbital plane is parallel to our point of view, and therefore they cross in front of the star from our point of view. Only a small percent of the planets do that. But knowing that ahead of time, that's a very calculatable statistic. And therefore, if all the stars you see, if 1% of them have planets that align with you, and if 1% of the stars you see have this characteristic tipping curve of planets passing in front of it, that would lead you to believe that nearly 100% of the stars have got planets when you drop. And I think that's approximately where they are right now. I think the prediction is that a very high percentage of stars have planets. It's almost the other way around. We used to think one star in a million would have planets. And maybe the answer is one star in a million doesn't have planets. And they all do. And of those planets they've detected so far, pretty large numbers, and they're starting to detect stars that have got 3, 4, 5, 6 planets that they can measure. And they're seeing multiple measurements of those planets. The good news is that stars, almost all of them have planets. The not so great news so far is that not many of the planets that we've discovered are in the Goldilocks zone, where water will be in a liquid form, therefore life as we know it can easily form. A high percentage of them are gas giants or in close to the star like Mercury, or too far away like Pluto, and so on. And so we're not detecting many planets of the right size in the right position. It does appear that an Earth-like planet is a relatively rare event. So we're kind of lucky on that one. But we're not alone when it comes to being in solar systems that have got planets. Lots and lots of those. And so this test satellite that's going to be looking across the whole sky simultaneously, as opposed to Kepler, which is looking at a chunk of sky that's an extremely small fraction of what you see as the angular extent of the moon in the azimuth and elevation, so to speak, right ascension and declination. If you look at the area of the moon, and a very small fraction of that area is what Kepler is looking at, just staring in one particular direction continuously. And so Kepler has been so darn successful. It's been extended, I think you said, up until 2016, launched in 2009. So it's detecting more and more stuff as we wait longer and longer. In fact, an awful lot of what it has detected. Let me drop.
Up to about 2,700. I just read it there.
Wow. 2,700 planets. Wow. In fact, now, are you talking about real planets or candidates? They've got a large number of candidate planets where they soar, they dip in light output once in order to be double darn sure they want to see it the second time. In other words, you see the dip once, you do the timing, and you figure out, okay, that's a planet that's got a orbit around that particular star, and it takes 4 years to do it. You'd like to see the second transit another 4 years later to be double darn sure that you're really seeing what you thought you saw. It's not just a glitch in the measurement, if you know what I mean. But these are rather subtle amounts of light change that we're looking for. So of the 2,700, do you believe that is essentially confirmed planets, Paul, or are those candidate planets? WS2N, K2LIW.
Candidate planets, 2,700. That's pretty good. I mean, it's staring at it. They said 140,000 stars in 1 month. And I believe the telescope is in a heliocentric orbit. It's not orbiting around Earth. So, we're following it along. So, which is kind of odd. I can never figure out. I'm not sure what point of the sky it's looking at. I should look into that unless you know, Dick. And if it's going around the sun, and at some point it won't be able to look at that one spot anymore. That's what gets me. You'll be looking at Sagittarius, and then you go around the sun, you'll be looking at different group of stars. If it looks back and keeps looking at the one spot, I mean, you could do that to some point, but eventually the sun's going to get in the way.
I'm in, Dick.
John recognized if Kepler was in orbit around the Earth, it would be experiencing a lot of disturbances of Earth-Moon system periodically going behind the Earth and whatever. To put it in a orbit similar to the Earth, put it in the solar orbit, you've got a great advantage in that far away from the Earth, undisturbed, and if you choose a chunk of sky you want to look at, that is above or below the ecliptic, above or below the plane of orbit, that means the point of view of the star, of the satellite, Kepler, is such that even when Kepler is on the backside of the sun, and maybe we're going to have trouble communicating with Kepler at that time, but it's got onboard store and forward of its information. So you're going to still get the data. So it's going to be delayed when it goes behind the sun. But even when it's on the backside of the sun, so to speak, if it's looking at a high enough elevation angle above the ecliptic, it never really gets blocked. Its point of view doesn't get blocked by the sun. So it can look at the patch of sky it's looking at, 365 and a quarter days per year. That's what I think is going on. I think they carefully chose a chunk of sky where they think, let me drop it. With the right number of stars of the right age group, similar to ours, that are likely to have planets, and they're far enough off of the plane of the orbit that you can look at them continuously, and the sun doesn't create a blockage. Go ahead, John, KC3WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, like you and I, we're interested in astronomy, as many of the guys in the net here are. Well, think about it. Once we understood the accretion disk, both the suns basically followed the same system of development. I think there's going to be billions of planets out there. What do you think, Dick?
Okay. The total number of stars in our solar system is around 10 to the 11, which is, what, 100 billion. The total number of galaxies is around 100 billion, 10 to the 11 again. So the 10 to the 22 stars in our observable range. And if 95% of those stars contain planets, and if the stars that contain planets have got, on average, let me pick a number, 5 planets, the bottom line is that the total number of planets in this universe is considerably greater than the number of stars. You've got 10 to the 22 stars that are observable. I didn't say you can easily pick out each one of them, because some of them are gone far away, but we're getting better and better telescopes all the time. If you've got 10 to the 22 stars, you probably have 10 to the 23 planets. Is that enough probability to have life? Just to put that number, 10 to the 23 power, in perspective. I'm going to do the calculation, but I think it's considerably greater than counting every single grain of sand on planet Earth. It's a huge number. With that much opportunity, is there life out there that we would be interested in? Absolutely, positively. As you know about that one chunk of physics that it seemed to be very well confirmed. Let me drop. The chunk of physics that I'm talking about is that there's a universal law that almost everybody believes, and that is if you have enough material undergoing some kind of interaction, and if it's interacting for a long enough period of time, every single event that can possibly happen will happen. Every possibility that is not forbidden is compulsory, if you've got enough that hope. We talk about a universe that since the Big Bang we now think is 13.8, used to be 13.7, 13.8 billion years, that's a lot of time, 10 to the 22 stars, 10 to the 23 planets, is that a lot of material? Is that a lot of the time? And by way of the Stanley Miller experiment that was done in around 1956, where you took a flask full of inert material, passed a spark through it, and you watch the amino acids being formed. And if it's in theory, everything we know says that if you wait long enough, you will watch life crawl out of that flask. All of the raw ingredients of life happens by just having the raw ingredients and spark passing through it, acting like lightning. And so the way that water was washing up on our shores, and the way that the bacteria was making oxygen and filling up the atmosphere, that's a process of life formation that probably will happen in a similar manner every time. And life as we know it is very tough. We've had 5 mass extinctions in the life of planet Earth. Something comes along like an asteroid or a comet or whatever, slams into the Earth, creates a nuclear winter, everything dies, and life starts all over again. We've been through that process 5 times. It's tenacious. So as I see it, it's not a matter of when we do the grand QXO in the sky. It's not a matter of if we're going to do it. It's a matter of when. I didn't say it's easy. Guarantee it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You can guarantee there's a lot of life out there. Now, finding it is going to be tough. The spacing between the stars is huge. And so we're at the point now where our best radio telescopes and transmitters could communicate X number of light years out there with a similarly equipped society by radio means. And is radio the best way? Should we you're communicating with laser beams or radio signals. There's a whole lot of questions and answers to all of that. So I'm going to make a rough guess, Paul, John, that there's 10 to the 23 planets in the observable universe. And now you saw how I came up with that number. KC2WGB. What number would you use, John? K2LIW in the tech net.
Well, Dick, I'll take it to the next step. Now, we can possibly have 10 to the 20th universes. So, it's like so obvious that there's something else going on. You're arrogant if you believe else. Other than that, I believe. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, on planet Earth, we've been knocked down in arrogance lots of times. For a ridiculous length of time, everybody wanted to believe the Earth was the center of the universe and all of those stars and planets revolve around us. We're the center. Well, soon found out it ain't going around us. An awful lot of what we see goes around the sun. And we thought the sun was the center. Well, the sun is just one of 10 to the 11 stars in this galaxy. Oh, the galaxy is the center. Well, the galaxy is a member of the local galactic group. All right, the galactic group is the center. Not necessarily. There's a whole lot of other galactic groups in this observable universe. Well, we're in the center of this universe. You think so? Not a chance. And this is the only universe, and we're in the center of it. We're in the best possible position. We're in a good position of this solar system, of this planet, this solar system, this galaxy, this galactic group. We're in a good position. Not the best, not the worst. We're midway between downtown and the suburbs of this particular galaxy, so to speak. Once every 260 million years, we make one circle around this galaxy. Some number like that. What was that again?
I have a comment.
Understand. So, the galaxy, there's a lot of life out there. Detecting is not going to be easy. But radio is one of the possible ways. And that's just if you use the electromagnetic spectrum. DC to light, as we call it. DC to gamma ray. Are there particular wavelengths there that are most desirable, that have most amount of penetration, the most amount of range, the most amount of focusing capability, the most amount of modulation? When the day comes that we can modulate gravity waves and send those out into space, that's another whole way of communicating. Go ahead with your comment on this one, Wes. Do you believe we're alone? N2XJN, K2LIW?
Well, the subject is extremely interesting. I have some addition to it, with your permission, so I can add to it. Starting with the Pathfinder from 1996 and the rest of it. As I believe the comment about what radioactivity for trigger much more interesting discussion. And to a shift.
There are people who believe that mankind has the capability of extrasensory perception. There are people who believe that you can start off with a piece of radioactive material, put it in front of the subject, and if the subject has a lot of ESP capability, he has the ability of telling the radioactive material, okay, I want you to emit now a little bit stronger, and I want you to emit a little bit weaker later. There are people who thought they had that capability, and some experiments along those lines have been run. When you get a naturally radioactive material doing its spontaneous emissions, it does it at extremely random times when it feels like it. And if you think by some simple chemical process on the outside, you're going to heat it up, you're going to slow it down, you're going to put in a strong magnetic field, a weak magnetic field, you're going to put in a strong electrostatic field, you're going to make it part of a chemical reaction. If you think you're going to do any of those things to stop, slow down, or speed up the rate at which that radioactive nucleus does its emitting, if you think you're going to be able to do that, there are a number of people out there who will say, no way in hell. That the amount of control you have over that is extremely small. So natural radiation of a radioactive material is something very difficult to modulate. And then something in the reverse procedure, if you decide that, okay, I want to take non-radioactive material, and by simple chemical, magnetic, electrostatic process, by some process that I can easily control in my laboratory, I'm going to take non-radioactive material and make it radioactive, or create a radioactive procedure out of non-radioactive materials. There are numbers of people who think they were going to do that. You can put as much effort into that as converting gold into lead into gold. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When you get down to calculating cross-sectional areas, and I'll just give you this one little part before I pass it back to you, Wes. Take a simple helium atom. Blow it up 30 trillion times in diameter. You do that, a helium atom, you blow it up 30 trillion times in diameter. That helium atom is now 2.5 miles in diameter. It's the same diameter as my town. 2.5 miles in diameter is the helium atom that I have blown up 30 trillion times. The nucleus in the center of that helium atom is the size of a golf ball. That gives you some idea of how difficult it is to create a nuclear reaction. To try to shoot a bullet at near speed of light, so it will do the penetrating of the outer shell and the inner shell and go into that nucleus. To shoot a bullet at near the speed of light with the accuracy that you're going to hit a golf ball in something the size of a city gives you just a little bit of an idea as to how difficult it is to create a nuclear reaction. And what Wes has been doing, let me drop. I'm going to make a couple of guesses here, Wes, and you can correct me on these guesses. I am guessing that in your early life, you lived in some fairly unpleasant places that were nowhere near as nice as the place where you live now. You've come to this country, you've become an American citizen, and you're very proud and like that American citizenship, and you want to stay here. And in return, you want to do something of benefit to those people. You would love to be able to give them energy independence. A fantastic goal if you can achieve a damn difficult goal. That's the good news. And you would like to be able to achieve energy-generating procedures that will make this country more energy independent. I wish that could be done. You are trying very hard to do it. You gather material, you talk to people who are seeking that goal. It's a very difficult goal. And some of those goals are doing it by procedures that look like they're nuclear. And as such, you're going to have to anticipate the tens and hundreds of ways that the experiment looks like it's successful and it might not be. You're going to have to find step by step every one of those possible errors that make the experiment look good and it might not. You have to find all of the things that the critics, you're going to get a lot of critics, and you have to literally find all the possible approaches the critics make to say, no, that's not what it is, and step by step prove each one of them is not the problem, if you know what I mean. You're going to get some flack. Thank goodness you're a tough guy and you can take it, because you're seeking a very difficult goal, and there's going to be a lot of critics out there with. As you can tell, I've made a bunch of guesses, and you can correct me. N2XJN, KQLIW in the Tech Man.
Dick, I missed what Wesley said about Pathfinder, WSLS.
Okay. Wesley can talk about Pathfinder or any of the above. Go ahead, Wes.
It might be a little bit long, but you are correct. I was living in a place that was not that pleasant, although I didn't suffer. I was extremely weak in this country. But I exchanged it for no longer the same kind of money that I had in communist regime, and I started from scratch. I'm very much proud that I'm an American citizen. And yes, I want to give something in exchange and give it for free. Thank you, Jeff. No patents. No patent rights. No litigation. Nothing. And of course, you may assign me someone who was trying 2 years ago. The lunatics were eventually delusional. but at the same time, there is a huge amount of people that is helping me out with it, so it's not only me. In order for me to start talking about the nuclear reaction, I need to first tell you, neither am I, neither you are the professional or having outstanding knowledge in this area, and you as well may consider yourself to be in error, but not.
I'm going to agree with that. My amount of knowledge of nuclear is extremely small. Go ahead, Wes.
Okay, that's excellent. But at first, I'm going to go to the space. But at first, for some, the three basic, because if we're going to continue that, we need to understand that the three basic the particles that we have that are very much noticed is alpha particles, beta, and gamma. And if you look at alpha, alpha is extremely heavy, and it does have extreme kinetic energy, about 5 million electrovolts. And it does contain 2 neutrons and 2 protons. The good thing is, this may consider to be extremely dangerous. It's not. It could be stopped by the skin, and it could be stopped by the paper. Beta particles. But a beta particle is only one proton, one neutron. Now, you were talking about helium. Well, with the helium, when you have the alpha particle, or let's say you have maybe you start from hydrogen. You don't have to go to helium. So, the high-speed electron that is for some time positron, or the positron is charged proton, speeding up about 500,000 meters per second. And did I get this right? Probably yes. I'm still trying to get the proper knowledge. Now, when it hits the atom, the atom can lose the electron. And then this electron is looking for the place to get there, and when we talk about a hydrogen atom, then we get in exchange something like a hydrogen 3, which would be the tritium, which is the radioactive isotope of hydrogen. And the nucleus of tritium sometimes is called tritium, which contains proton and 2 neutrons, whereas the nucleus of protonium contains 1 proton and no neutron. The good thing about it, it could be stopped by a very thin sheet of aluminium. And the last one is gamma. Well, gamma is mostly photons, or extremely high-speed electrons. This thing is extremely dangerous, but could be stopped by a few millimeters to 1 centimeters of lead. Depends from, of course, the kinetic energy. But if we try to compare the kinetic energy of alpha particles, which is about 5 mega electrovolt, to beta, we're going to find out that beta is about 100 kilo electrovolt. So it's not that dangerous. Now, why did I start with that? Well, the interesting fact is that when Pathfinder was launched, it was 1996, and it did have at that time emerging technology, which was SRS, and which was alpha proton X-ray spectrometer. As we know, alpha is not really very much Speedy, it's a mass, huge mass particle, comparing to Beta and comparing to the Gamma, which either one is smaller and smaller. Now, the XRS is the technology that is being used for identifying any particle substance in the universe if you want to, and that's to the properties of X-ray. And we're talking about the gamma. Gamma goes to X-ray, and then alpha particles, protons, X-ray protons from the specimen could be extracted because of one single mechanism. When you put the X-rays to any specimen, X-rays are created by the ejection of one electron followed by spinning from higher shell. In other words, those from that matter is bouncing back the X-ray or gamma radiation in slightly different frequency. And one of the methods that was applied in that spacecraft was X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy, which is a high energy X-ray photon absorbed by atom is ejecting and ionizing an electron from the 1K shell to 2 to L shell, I mean from K shell to L shell. And then the detector is able to see the difference and qualify the proper material. So that's how the knowledge came to the science about what we can find on Mars. So again, as a summary, the good news is that every element emits X-ray photons at slightly different wavelengths. The particle in dark in X-ray emission, being called PIXE, the PIXE is the same as XRF, which is used to qualify metal, especially in junkyards, richer one, because the stuff costs a good quite a few $1,000s, starting from used one about $15,000 and up. Actually, I was lucky. I've got Ranger, which is the primary tool that was used in Iraq to quantify nuclear material, but also widely used by Army and CIA and FBI. I was lucky enough to get one. I'm waiting for the delivery. It does give me the specification and assignment using the special algorithm of uraniums, any kind, plutoniums, radiums, potassium, cesium, thorium, cobalt, bariums, bismuth, galliums, idiums, ionite, xenon, and palladium, and plenty of others. Now, what I was interested with is because I was warned by Dick that I might be in error with my findings. I wanted to have something that will confirm that really I'm not in error, as this device is not only able to assign the particular radioactive specimen, but also is able to detect neutrons. So it's a pretty much handy device. I've got it extremely inexpensively for 1/20th of the original price. So, talking about the new one starts from $20,000 and up. Coming back to the space, the 9 radioactive helium sources were mounted on this particular spacecraft, and the alpha particles were analyzed by three spectroscopy devices. The APXS is another variation of the technology, but it was also used widely prior to Mars mission in geological measurements based on the three interactions of alpha particles with the radioisotope source. That was Rutherford effect scattering, photo emission, and X-ray fluorescence. Not going to go deeply to it and just wrap it up, the space part of it. They found a prison. Chromium, manganese, iron, nickel, and zinc, which is pretty nice, like for the small spacecraft. Now, rover stopped roving at March 22nd, 2010. That would be about space. The only addition is that tritium is just a variation of hydrogen with three electrons in it. That's what it is.
I'm pretty sure that tritium has one proton, two neutrons, one electron. You said three electrons. I'm pretty sure it's got one electron. Tritium is a isotope of hydrogen, one beyond deuterium, another isotope of hydrogen. And so the number of protons determines what the material is, hydrogen versus helium. The number of neutrons of that element determines whether or not it's an isotope or not. So it's still got one electron. Chemically, it behaves in a somewhat similar manner, I believe. And deuterium and tritium is being used on some of these inertial confinement experiments for hydrogen fusion being done by the United States Ignition Facility, because I guess the greater number of neutrons in that nucleus allows a slightly larger cross-section, therefore easier to create a nuclear reaction. Whenever someone talks about trying to create a nuclear reaction, they frequently use the word cross-section. And I think what they're really talking about is cross-section of the nucleus. That's that golf ball in the city-sized example I gave of helium. I just chose helium. Many other atoms wouldn't be that different when you describe the size of the nucleus versus the size of the whole atom. The real point is that the nucleus is such an extremely small object that its cross-section, the ability of having your bullet, so to speak, out of your accurate rifle, hit that particular target, is that degree of difficulty of having high-speed bullets near the speed of light with the right accuracy to hit that small target in order to create a nuclear reaction. That's my example. It may not be
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, you're right. It has a one proton and two neutrons. I misspoke.
Minor detail. John, you wanted to say something on KC2WGB? K2RIW?
And WS2N also.
Okay, John and Paul in that order. Go ahead, John.
To exactly what you were talking about, that's why Canada uses heavy water instead of light water reactors like we do. That same reason.
Okay. Paul, you got it.
Okay, so at the end, I think Wesley said that one of the spacecraft stopped operating in March. I'm pretty sure he didn't mean Pathfinder March, 2010. But that was Spirit that quit working. Sojourner was the microwave-sized rover that they first sent up was right about that, and it did have the alpha proton X-ray spectrometer on board. But so did the other ones. Spirit had it, and Opportunity has it, and now Curiosity has one too, but much more improved. They used to have to sit at night for 10 hours with Sojourner just to get a reading. Put up against a rock, and eventually they get a reading on what kind of material they were looking at. And now they do it 1, 2, 3, and they don't have to wait at night. Curiosity can just, you know, put this quick test on there and just drive away pretty much right after they do it. So the equipment has really been upgraded. That was Sojourner, a little rover, and now Pathfinder is the lander itself, dropping. And of course it was renamed Carl Sagan Memorial after it had landed there. I like that mission for one particular reason, because they had natural cameras on both the rover and on the Pathfinder. The Pathfinder doesn't move, it just stayed there. But it was able to follow the rover around and then take pictures of it, you know, as it drove around. I thought that was pretty neat. Of course, you can't do that with Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity. Of course, they do a self-portrait of themselves. They slice a bunch of pictures together and they show the rover sitting there. But it's an interesting perspective when you're looking at the thing from a distance, driving around with little wheels, and that was a really great mission. Back to you, Dick. WX1.
Sound correct, thing is, we had a Spirit and we had a Pathfinder. So Spirit stopped working at the March 27, 2007.
Now, Paul, let me ask you this question. Many of the spacecraft that are on the surface of Mars, put there by NASA, I have the impression have either the exact machine or a variation of an alpha proton X-ray spectrometer, APXS. I'm going to guess that the reason that particular piece of hardware is there is that possibly it has a nuclear source on board, possibly you take your unknown material on Mars, expose it to the nuclear source, look at the stuff, rays, and whatever that reflects back. By looking at the spectrum of what comes back from your sample that is exposed to that machine, by way of that spectrum, I think you have the ability to identify whether you've got this kind of rock and that kind of element, whatever. I think it helps you identify what is the content, what are the constituents of a sample that's being investigated by that piece of apparatus. Is that approximately what it's doing, and is that approximately how it does it? WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, and it took a long time, like I said, around 10 hours for each sample to Sojourner. Now that's done very quickly, which is nice because they say, okay, this is interesting, let's move on. But yeah, they bombard the rocks with protons. You know, whatever came back was, you know, reading whatever detected that they also had it on that rover would detect the emissions coming back, and it could tell if it was false, you know, or volcanic or whatever kind of rock it was. They did find out a lot of the rocks on Mars were similar to what they had on Earth. So now, of course, with Curiosity, they do that and they'll say, okay, this is very interesting. Let's drill into the rock now. And then now they have that capability where they'll drill into the rock and they'll take fine powder from it and maybe a symbol for a very, very little sample, and they'll put it into the body of the rover. Curiosity has the sample analyst on Mars to actually cook the materials, you know, with with the spectrometers on board, they really can get fine detail of what exactly they're looking at. And the same with the Kenman drop it. And I think Kenman is one that they actually heated up in the gas that they come off. If that comes off of it, they detect what it's made of. I think the sample analysis of Mars, SAM, that pretty much takes in the atmosphere that's on Mars, or the atmosphere that's surrounding these particles or something, and it detects what it's made out of. So both instruments are inside the body of Curiosity, and they do similar but not the same job.
Simple.
Go ahead, John.
I'd like to know, with all of the investigation they're doing, I know they're building a composite geological profile, I assume, of Mars. Have they started a mineral profile of the percentage of, say, heavy metals, like, you know, gold or mercury? Have they found anything like that? Do we have any reports coming back like that? Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to pass it over to Paul for that, and I am guessing, Paul, all of this investigation of Curiosity's laboratory is to try to find out evidence of past water events, evidence of past simple microbial life events. In other words, there's life on Mars, that Mars had water, and that warm past. I presume that's one of the major motivations to this. So on top of that, along these lines, as I see it, you send a elaborate enough laboratory like Curiosity to Mars and let it right on the spot find the right rock, drill a hole into it, get some of the dust, analyze the dust, to analyze it on the spot with the right kind of laboratory that's there seems to me to be the right way. From time to time, various NASA-like officials have said that, gee, it would be nice to go down to Mars, go down to this asteroid, scoop up some of the material and bring it back home. The degree of difficulty of bringing something back is so difficult that I think we're way ahead of the game of shipping the right laboratory there and talking to it by way of telemetry. That's my feeling on that one. I got a bunch of questions on that, by way of John and me, Paul. Answer any of the above. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, well, if they could bring a rock back from this area and rock back from that area, like what John said, you know, you could eventually map out when you know, the different areas where they have, that would be good. And then you could analyze things real quick back here on Earth. Except that's a little on the difficult side to go from one area of Mars to another and collect all these different rocks, put it onto a Mars descent vehicle and send it back to Earth. Big, costly project. Doable, but it's a lot easier to do what they're doing. And it's so easy that they decided to do another flight. You brought up a while back that they're going to have another Curiosity-type mission. Same type of thing with the RTGs, the power and all, the plutonium source. Same kind of landing type of craft with the crane, and it has worked out. And like what John, you were saying about the mapping of the minerals, I haven't heard about gold or anything like that, but I'm sure they map every little area that the probers do go to. Curiosity doesn't have much on its odometer yet. It's a half a mile, it's probably a lot, I think a little bit more maybe. The other ones have 17 or more miles on it. Opportunity does. Spirit had a lot of miles on it. So it's still only a small area of Mars. They've got the Viking missions they detected, whatever they detected. They weren't able to move around. Sojourn only went a couple hundred feet here and there, maybe the length of a football field. That's about it. So it's not enough of an area to start mapping out what's where, but they're getting a good idea from orbit. You know, you have they can tell what's going on by all the orbiting spacecraft, especially Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's
Paul, maybe you can comment on the wind conditions.
Five Viking missions that landed, they all, each one had an orbiter. We had two Viking missions. Each one had an orbiter. And then more sophisticated ones within the last decade or two, you have Mars Odyssey still operational. Mars Global Surveyor, that one has quit. That was up before Odyssey. We've got Mars Express by European Space Agency, that's still in orbit. These things are all looking down, taking, you know, you can actually tell what minerals are pretty much in what area. Similar to what they did on Star Trek years ago, you know, they look down on a planet and say, oh, this planet, this is there and that's there. It seems kind of far-fetched. Now they're doing it. But it's being done. Where Curiosity is now, drop it. I mean, they've already noticed that there aren't any of these doubles, these little whirlpool windstorms that go by on a regular basis where Curiosity was and Spirit, which cleaned off their solar panels and all. They noticed so there is a difference weather-wise. I'm sure there's a big difference in mineralized. The minerals that they found in Curiosity's area tend to be more supportive of past water than what the other probes were. So there's differences. Like Dick, to send astronauts, that would be a good thing. You could land on a planet, bring all your instruments, and drop it. Mars had, you know, a nice little setup. Get your spectrometers there and all your gadgets similar to what you have on Curiosity. But it was so easy. I mean, you know, just grab a rock, bring it in, bang it around, test it. You could probably do a 1, 2, 3 where, you know, Curiosity's got to slowly drill through the rock, get a little dust. You know, it takes days, sometimes weeks before they can get one test result. You know, when all you got is time, you know, Curiosity and this next rover that's going to be going up, as far as I'm concerned, my money's on that. It's safer, it's cheaper. You just have to wait a while. You're not going to get the quick results of an astronaut picking up a rock, bringing it into the Mars tab, and doing a couple of tests, 1, 2, 3. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
It's nice to dream about putting a man there, but as we've said so, I've said so often, extremely difficult. What it takes to maintain life in a human being in space is basically heroic. And to put a man on a planet that is considerably colder than Antarctica in the wintertime, at night, considerably colder, 200-mile-an-hour type winds, an atmosphere that is 0.5% of the atmosphere of the Earth, unbreathable, there's just not enough of it there. Because of the lack of the ionosphere and atmosphere, you have no protection from ultraviolet rays, cosmic rays, and solar wind, and so on. So it's a pretty wicked place. If you were offered the opportunity to go to Mars to be a researcher on a one-way mission, would you take it, Paul? WS2N? I know it's a tough question, but there's a lot of glory involved, my goodness, the end game is not so pleasant. Would you accept the opportunity, Paul? WS2N, KQLAW?
No, not at this stage of my life. When I was younger, I would go, as long as there was a return trip involved, you know. Especially the first flight or two, you know. You remember when they went to the moon? Remember when they first shot a guy into space? He didn't even orbit, you know, Alan Shepard. They gave him a ticker tape parade, but not too many people remember they remember the first mission that went to the moon. They quickly forget about the other.